The intention behind leading the Lad Way is to create a safe space to relate, release, and recharge our passion for people, remembering that diversity and inclusion are critical components to our shared humanity and our ability to help transform lives.
Good morning. Welcome to Critical Reflections. This is the second season of my Truth and Reconciliation Project grant. We're moving past the grant though now. We are kind of in brand new territory here where I'm actually getting the opportunity to talk to people in a much broader kind of way. We're still going to be focusing on issues of potentially race and media and representation, but we're going to really expand that model into looking at diversity and inclusion across all aspects and factions of culture. And I'm really excited today because this particular kickoff is going to be part of a monthly series that I'll be doing with LAD, who's the organizing sponsor behind the Over the Rhine International Film Festival. I'm a LAD employee. I work for the festival. And this is going to be a great opportunity for me to have the chance to talk to some employees who work at the organization, people that I know or may not know as well, but it's going to be a great opportunity to get to know them as people and as employees and find out how their identities have kind of helped shape their roles within the organization. And hopefully what we'll ultimately really be seeing is how those individual pieces come up and create a collective kind of understanding that we can then take into the world and use as a model for supporting people. So I'm really excited today to kick things off with Jason Harris. And as I've already told Jason, I'm really excited about this. And I want to just dive in and have Jason introduce himself to you all. So Jason, I'm going to turn it over to you.
So this isn't always my strong suit of introducing myself, but there's a lot of different facets to me. I'm an autistic person who uses that as a cultural identity, as well as understanding with some of the, you know, needs and access that I need, which would go with the idea of sort of the impairment model, but also using it as something that is considered something that is a collective of understanding. I really like to understand culture and the way things work and why we set up what is, which this is, I don't know if this is dropping in October, but this is my time where I try to reflect a lot on horror and what a horror means and stuff. And there's a lot of intersections with that and disability, because it's not the horror itself that's interesting. It's the underlying messages behind that, or the sort of allegories behind that, that I think are really interesting. I think there's a lot of things because of that, because of my past and feeling like we wouldn't before identifying as somebody who is autistic and trying to figure out and still trying to figure out what that means and how I can bring positive and focus on more of the positives rather than some of the things where I used to have more of a negative view of myself, or I needed to overcome my autism or when I took a class called Disability Culture and Equity, which really focused on disability as part of humanity and what it means to be human rather than something just to overcome or to fix, it sort of changed my perspective, and it sort of fit with some of the things that I like of, like, why do we do the things that we do? Why do we think certain ways? What does it mean to be human? So I sort of took that and then got a disability studies degree in graduate school because it really interested me, which also opened me up to intersectionality and sort of how that aligns with race and gender and sexuality and how we think about that, or how we include things or how we disinclude things, and how movements work. And so I've been sort of able to have, for good or bad, depending on how some people think of it, a sort of theoretical view of some of these things, which has been in some ways helpful for my own life, and then also just being able to think about it and how disability really in some ways applies to all of us, not because all of us necessarily have disability at some point, but because we all have capabilities, but we all have things that we're not as good at, and we all have stressors and things that ask too much of us, and being able to be open with the fact that it's okay to not be machines I mean, there's a lot of cool sort of theoretical things that I think also can apply across the board, but also doesn't take away the uniqueness of what it means to be disabled.
Right.
So you know, I don't know if I introduced myself or more.
That was perfect because, again, what you did is, and my head is kind of spinning as I'm kind of sitting here thinking through and trying to process everything that you said. But you hit a couple of high points that I want to kind of use as a starting point for a conversation. And I think the first one out of there is you talked about the idea of really kind of looking at and exploring disability culture. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and again, I always say this, let's try to move beyond the quick little sound bites of what that might mean. I'm curious, in your case, how do you define disability culture for yourself? How do you see that term kind of coming together?
Yeah, so I think a lot of times we think about disability as an individualized thing, that's an impairment or something. But I think because it's a marginalized group, but because there's also ways that people figure out how to navigate the world and might have commonalities, the disabled people are starting to come together in collectives, which hasn't always happened when you've had these top-down service models or sort of things of thinking about disability, and started to be able to talk to each other and say, like, hey, how does this work for you? Or what does this mean? Or have you faced this sort of situation where somebody's made this assumption about you and it's created this idea of, oh, this is who I am and how do I adapt to make things work for me, not just do what somebody who doesn't live in that positionality tell me how to do, because and you learn a lot from each other in some ways. And I think it's really important because it sort of takes that empowerment thing. You know, I mean, there's so many things that I've learned from other autistic people about what it means to be autistic, or, you know, like I've learned, like, oh, I'm not just a picky eater. I have said some of that is a sensory thing. So it's not like, and it's sort of making it that you're not just alone, or it's not just something wrong with you. It's just a different way of being, but you also do face a world that doesn't understand it or wants you to be like, that sees it as just a biological deformity or something that's biologically different. And in some ways, and sort of idea of a medical model of disability, which is only like a cure and treat sort of thing that goes more towards diseases, but also sees disability like that. It sort of wants to prevent it or make it so that somebody appears more normal. And so, like, how do you navigate a world that wants you to fit in a certain box when your way of being in that world, it may be different? And how do you deal with the fact that people don't always understand the way that your positionality is, but then also trying to figure it out for yourself and hearing how other people navigate and sort of, you know, I mean, there's things with autistic culture too, because we think about like certain things as being fixed, like stairs have to exist, like that's how you move. And it's like, well, no, you can have ramps. Like, why do we always have to, why do social constructs can also be similar? You can have sort of social agreements and stuff, and there can be culture, and there can be things like going on rants can be part of autistic culture, or say, or, you know, being more, a little bit more, you know, to the point, right? Not necessarily always blunt, as somebody says, but more like, hey, can I say this real quick? Or, oh, well, or jumping around. I mean, there's sort of things where, you know, being able to rewrite sort of the some of these scripts to be able to meet what you think works instead of having it to be the way that somebody else says it has to be.
You know, this is fascinating. Again, this is one of the things I love about these conversations, because you kind of come into it, you think you have a couple of questions and you're ready to go, but then, you know, it opens up and different directions and avenues kind of pop up. And I'm loving this right now, because one of the things, again, and I get the feeling this is going to happen throughout this entire conversation, but, you know, you talked about the idea of moving from, you know, that individualized kind of approach to, you know, a person with a disability, which is kind of in some ways the same issue that you see across marginalized groups. We start off initially seeing ourselves as individuals, but then what kind of has to happen is at some point, the larger society may see us as a collective, but really what has to happen for us as individuals, we have to interact with other people who are part mm-hmm. of our groups. And yeah. you form those smaller communities where you have the opportunity to say, hey, here's my experience. Let me hear about your experience. And then you start to see within that smaller community, there's mm-hmm. a culture that kind of emerges, or there are those similarities that will you'll start to recognize. And then you can kind of move from the individual to a smaller group, to larger groups, to eventually you do hit that full collective. So yeah. I'm fascinated by hearing you say that again. What had to happen is you had the opportunity to meet other people who are autistic, and again, kind of share experiences.
And sort of like in a place where it's, online or stuff, because there's a lot of disability Twitter or Crip Twitter, which is Crip mm-hmm. is sort of like the reclaiming of the word cripple, which more focuses on physical disabilities, but also mean there can be some intersections and stuff, and being able to hear from that and like, oh, well, this idea of independence is like complete independence is not, like is a little bit overblown. I mean, we're all interdependent in some ways. And why is it that some like things are considered valuable and like it's okay. Mm-hmm. And being able to be, thinking about how we can support each other, and that, even the ideas of like, no matter who we are, we all have limits of our capacities to be able to do something. Uh-huh. We can get over either mind or body. There's ways that, we can only do so much, and being expected to be on all the time or be doing mm-hmm. it like 24/7 or a certain way. So, I mean, even I think abroad, colder, but being able to sort of take those and hear about it. And, I think the way that we talk about it in a lot of my early life, until I sort of learned about it, and I still deal with it a little bit, is dealing with shame of having mm-hmm. like seen as defective or something wrong with me, or or that, oh, you overcome your disability, or you're so inspirational because you can do these everyday things, but it doesn't necessarily mean a meaningful, And I think when you go into those groups, because there's a lot of groups and stuff, but you can mm-hmm. have, it's really driven by by disabled people themselves or people with disabilities themselves, instead of this sort of top-down program that's just trying to fit people in, because that has been one of the harder parts. And I think that's one of the reasons that we don't necessarily always think about disability as a culture, is because a lot of things are top-down, mm-hmm. especially around intellectual and developmental disabilities.
Right. I'm hearing in this, and again, it's fascinating looking at it, as a member of another marginalized group. Like, for me, part of this dynamic that's really fascinating, and it's one of those things that I'm still kind of figuring out for myself too, as a Black American, I kind of see and understand that obviously, there are as many kind of different perspectives, if you will, for Black Americans, from how we want to be recognized and call what we want to call ourselves, to again how we move through the world. But then there's this other level of it too, which for me is now as a film critic, I'm starting to think more about what is it like to look at those other Black stories and Black filmmakers from outside the United States, because we may all kind of fall under the heading, if you will, of Black, mm-hmm. but a Black person's experience from the United States, maybe from the South, like me, I'm from North Carolina, it's going to be different than the Black experience of someone who was in London.
Yeah.
And again, it's kind of like, okay, if I have the opportunity to see stories and to talk to people, whether they're filmmakers or, other kinds of artists or whatever, if I can talk to them and find out about what was their Black experience like where they were, then all of a sudden it's like, okay, I can kind of piece that together. I can compare it to my experience here, and there are going to be some similarities and some differences. But again, that'll be part of, in effect, forming an even larger kind of culture. Yeah.
that's so interesting around disability too, because you get it from regionality and sort of different cultures and stuff, and what is considered disability and how disability is considered is so different throughout different cultures and time. And because, but also you get it based on the positionality of a disability. Sometimes there's different sort of camps. Disability is this wide umbrella term, just sort of like, you know, but then there's sort of groups a little bit. I mean, and then also there's things around it with intersectionality that also, you know, disability is one identity and it can be a major identity. It can be a minor identity, but it also crosses race and gender and sexuality and other sort of things. And, you know, a lot of times disability has been very white and male. And a lot of times there's even hierarchies where physical disability sort of, veterans and people have acquired disabilities have been the ones you've most been listened to. And then, and you see that a lot in film depictions. And then and sort of you see some of the things with people with physical disabilities who've had it, like, and then sort of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities are sort of at the bottom. And then you sort of have these outliers of mental health, not that they're outliers, but sometimes they think of themselves as part of the disability community. Sometimes because of the way the disability is associated, like, I don't want to do that. And that's true with learning this, the U.S. context of learning disabilities as well, because if you're talking about it in the U.K., like you said, learning disability is equivalent to your intellectual disability. And so, and I think it is interesting too, because like there's questions of like, if somebody has, you know, if somebody's dyslexic and the society doesn't read, is it a disability? Or, you know, or there's even like, is there positives? You know, like, what does somebody who brings, like, and I think sometimes we think of it as like, you know, like, we'll see her things like that person is blind to the possibilities, or it fell on deaf ears. It's sort of euphemisms of talking, and we sort of see those positionalities as being wrong. But what if there's a different way of perceiving the world? It also brings different things to it. And that also goes within the idea of different cultures and stuff. Like there's Black sign language that came through segregation, and there's different things of where, you know, I mean, and that's one of the interesting things too, is that disability in some ways has been used to justify oppression of so many groups. It can be hard for different marginalized groups to talk about disability, understandably, because of some of the ways that it's been used to justify racism or sexism or transphobia or homophobia or, you know, something, you know, is, oh, well, there's something medically wrong with somebody, or they're not as intellectually, or even the opposite idea of, oh, they're so much better, where it becomes mean. And that's one of the tough things with the diagnostic boxes, is that diagnostics are broad brushes of things, and it's hard to talk about it on an individual level. And sometimes those diagnostics take it, you know, I mean, and you can see that sometimes with ADHD and autism, where sort of everything gets stuck to them, that's like, that seem is wrong with society in some ways.
You know, this is, again, another fascinating kind of piece of this, because again, now as, you know, a program and artistic director for a film festival that is trying to find ways to kind of ground disability within this larger conversation about diversity and inclusion, one of the things that I have found fascinating is, you know, we're getting submissions from filmmakers from around the world. And especially for the films that are going to focus on disability, there's this kind of interesting dynamic. And it's one of those things that I'm looking forward to spending more time working with you and talking with you through some of these ideas, because ultimately, you know, I feel like part of the concern that we have as a programming team is you may see the language and, you know, the, I guess in a sense, the idea of disability culture from another perspective, where they may use different language, they may talk about things and situations in different ways than we do here. And there's, we kind of find ourselves, you know, having a question of, okay, you know, this film came to us from a particular community, maybe, you know, in Europe or in Africa or the Middle East, and we may not be comfortable with the way they are talking about disability. Mm-hmm. And the question becomes, you know, are we imposing, you know, our understanding or our language or our values on another culture? And how do you kind of address those kinds of issues? And I'm kind of curious. Yeah. I mean, like I said, I know that we are going to continue having more of these conversations as we continue to work together and the festival grows. But I think this is a great place to kind of start maybe having an idea of this conversation. How do you feel about, again, disability culture as it kind of crosses nationalities and other parts of the world?
Yeah, I do think it's really, really important to understand the national context and sort of things and make sure that it's being culturally sensitive or understood, just because so many different places are in different places with the understanding mm-hmm. of disability and stuff. Now, that doesn't mean that everything goes though, too, because mm-hmm. unfortunately, you see, I mean, ableism has existed throughout history. It is really one of the old, I mean, you know, I mean, you can see it also with sort of anti, you know, things against women. It's one of the older forms that sort of mm-hmm. exists throughout time and cultures in some way, seeing like Greeks throwing babies off that they found effective, or even, you know, things like fairies or changelings being seen as god, like goblins taking away your children to be something around mm-hmm. that. So, I mean, there's also cultures that are prize disability, or even, I mean, you know, there's places in, you know, and it's not always, but I mean, I guess it depends on the outcome too, because there's places in different parts of Africa where albinism is still something that can either be revered or get something mm-hmm. It's really important to understand the context and understand how Western imperialism has also, as uh-huh. well as some of the things, have influenced the way that different cultures have thought about different things, and but that ableism can exist throughout cultures and time. And so, what is it that's coming from like a Western perspective, and we're like, oh, this isn't, and what is it? Because I think it's interesting, and it doesn't necessarily mean that it absolves it, but it also means you do have to be more mindful that, you know, just as there's different cultures throughout even the United States, that to be culturally aware of what's going on and not just put your mores on it, but understand that ableism can exist no matter where it is.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now that leads to, and again, we spent a lot of time kind of talking about sort of this personal and almost theoretical approach to it all. Now I'm kind of curious to take that perspective and now bring it into an organizational or an institutional approach. Like,
yeah.
How, first of all, if you could, for the, you know, again, for the listeners who may not know your exact role at LAD, could you tell us your job title and give us a brief kind of overview of your role as a LAD employee?
So my job title is Director of Strategic Operations. And, you know, I mean, I think it's like some job titles, it's a little bit vague. And I think we're still trying to figure out, is this is a new adventure for LAD to focus not just on the service models or the institutional sort of things, even though those are important, but focus more on the cultures and stuff, whether it's around disability, whether it's around people who are working with people with disabilities, whether it's around race and disabilities, and being able to think about how these systems can benefit a lot of different people. And disability services have not always been driven by people who are getting the supports or the families. Mm-hmm. So being able to take in those perspectives and think about it as more than just something to overcome. It's how to live your life with a, mm-hmm. a different way of being or disability in some ways. And also focusing on a lot of the, you know, what it is that you want, what are your positives. A lot of it, at least mm-hmm. in some of when I was growing up, was a lot of overcoming. So being able to bring some of those perspectives and be able to think about some of those things. I mean, my role is still defining and being able to do some of that education, because we have some systems of disability, but they reflect some of the older systems of institutions, and they reflect some of the other sort of things. There's still parts of eugenics that go in with race and disability, mm-hmm. and sexuality and sort of social conformity. And not that we all don't have a way to be, no matter who we are, disability or not, be part of a society and not necessarily, but not also forcing one way of being on somebody either.
Right.
And so being able to take some of those things, and, you know, disability services are a lot about compliance bases because of some of the abuses and stuff that happen. How can we get more towards a model of thinking about how to do things because it's about a thing of excellence? A lot of disability services and stuff are about making sure that you're, and I mean, they're started to go to things like person-centered and other sort of strategies, but it seems like at this point it's really more just on paper, and the execution of that is so hard. But that's also tough when people are underpaid or undervalued, it seems, because usually if you're working with a class of people that is considered burdens or not that important, then your role is sometimes considered that, and that can affect everybody within the systems, because these things are not just into the individuals with disabilities, it affects the people around it, the ideas of some of the ways that we think about being productive and stuff is something, I mean, there's so many different interesting facets of that, or that sometimes I think some of the ingenuity, obviously some of the ways that some of the systems are set up are because there was abuses and neglect and things of disability, and that's important that that's not happening. But I think sometimes it stakes out innovation or being able to do new things or being able to focus more one-on-one, because there's a cost imperative to it, because there's limited funding, and because anything that could cause like an incident or things is more important to not have to fill out more paperwork, which I get it, paperwork is tedious. And I think that's something that is true through a lot of social services throughout, you know, whoever is trying. And there's not a lot of talking together between service models. So how so disability sort of gets in its silo, and it doesn't go with mental health, it doesn't go with housing, it doesn't go within urban renewal and working within Black communities, you know, or other marginalized communities. You know, I think one of the interesting things you think about is like when you talk about disability and what it means to be disabled, like we think of disability in the United States as a very individual thing, and like it's all about that person with disability. But if you're coming from families that maybe immigrant families or stuff, it's more of a family model approach, and there's some things with that, and that's still sort of like, but how is that, you know, and being able to think about that, or, you know, taking the different cultures into account of what this means or what it doesn't. It's so important to sort of have these dynamic, and as much as government is important to provide some infrastructure, it can also cause some things that make it so that you either fit into the systems or you don't. And I'm a person, because of my positionality of being somewhat in a gray area of disability, that a lot of times I don't fit into the way that the systems work.
Right.
And I think it was really interesting when I was doing LEND, 25% of people in Ohio get some type of services, but that means 75% don't. And there's and there's probably a lot of different reasons why.
Okay, now, and again, I'm going to question you here about something, or again, a distinction between the two, because it's in my head. I'm curious, because again, you have talked an awful lot about how systems work. And again, I kind of introduced that with the whole institutional organizational approach. But no, I think there's something curious about that, because I feel like there's a unique distinction between systems and culture. You know, and I feel like to a certain extent, the idea and the way that we use systems is almost really almost like talking about organizational culture.
Mm-hmm.
But as part of that, there is something that is missing, because ultimately you don't necessarily work or strive towards having an institutional identity, but we do talk about cultural identities.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I feel like there's this interesting distinction between those two that in some ways is why I now can think about and appreciate the idea of disability culture.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can, like I said, there's, because it's yes, it's person-centered, but again, it's about kind of an awareness and an understanding of how a group interacts with itself, but then also kind of has to deal with the reflection that it offers to the society as a whole. Whereas I don't feel like systems do that, or don't necessarily feel like they work in quite the same way.
No, systems are really the idea of some of the ways that the systems, it seems like, or it seems like it's supposed to design a framework around
mm-hmm.
what you do. But I think what happens sometimes with those systems is it takes away some of the thinking that needs to go into making it so it's more culturally relative.
Mm-hmm.
That it just says, this is the way it's supposed to be done and you're supposed to be in, which is sort of an imperialist sort of thing. I mean, we can see that within other ways of like sometimes like people coming into different societies or going into, you know, other cultures across the world and saying, okay, here's the system, it works. It doesn't take into account the individuality, even though it should.
Right.
I think it's supposed to, at its core, it's supposed to be frameworks. It's supposed to be sort of the bottom line of like, okay, but it's supposed to be more than that. But I think the way the funding works and that it's so, there's so mm-hmm. many things that makes it tough. I think also, but they do interplay too, because I think a lot of culture is a reaction to systems, and systems mm. don't work, or that marginalize.
Okay. Okay. Well, and this, again, this leads us back to sort
Sorry,
of the base. No, this is great, because this takes us back to the basics for me, because ultimately, you know, I'm doing this podcast and we're talking about all of these issues, but at the fundamental level for me, it's all about representation, especially media representation. So
yeah.
Once you have found a way to establish, you know, a meaningful look at and understanding of what a culture is, then you're able to tell stories.
Yeah.
And share stories from that culture. So my question to you now is, we've had this conversation where we've walked ourselves up to the doorstep now of representation. And my question for you is, and again, I think I've mentioned this before, like whether you're talking about film or television and streaming or whatever, what have been some of the, you know, give me a couple of examples if you can of shows or characters or whatever where you felt like you saw what felt like an accurate representation of your story or a close kind of approximation to your story somewhere out there in that larger cultural conversation?
I mean, I don't always. What, I mean, I think it's some, I mean, just because I'm not always, you know, I'm interested in some of the cultural dynamics of it, but I look at it more as a big thing. And I haven't watched most things just because sometimes mm-hmm. it feels like disability studies and it takes away some of the things. But when I watched Special, I think it was one of my favorite, just because I think
okay.
it goes with the dynamic of like trying to find yourself in a world that doesn't necessarily or sees you as like, if you have like, like trying to cover up your disability because
uh-huh.
you don't want people to see you as less, or you know, and sort of those dynamics of trying to find yourself and see who you are, whether it's around sexuality or whether it's around your job or uh-huh. friendships and stuff. And I think that interesting dynamic between, you know, parent and person with disability or disabled person was such an interesting thing. And I do need to watch the representation. Now, I think that was one of the better shows because it was written by somebody with a disability. And I think that's one of the things that disability is where other movements were 20, 30 years ago, where things around disability are still mainly written about people with disabilities and maybe has a disabled actor, but it also doesn't have people with disabilities within the rooms and sort of thing. So it really still reflects a lot on what society thinks of people with disabilities and more as a micro lens on how non-disabled people think about disabled people.
Right. And yeah, you're right. And again, I feel like we've had hints of this conversation before, just talking about sort of that lag time as far as, you know, where groups are and how quickly they're able to catch up in that cultural conversation. Because, you know, when I graduated from college, I started working in the social service field pretty much right out of college back in 91. And eventually worked my way up to staff training. And one of the things that we were talking about, and again, it kind of shows who I was back in the mid-90s. I was still a guy who was really into film, who was going to see movies all the time. I wasn't reviewing them yet, but it was kind of the seed was there. But I was using film in my classes, and I was talking about the idea that, for instance, you had, you know, Rain Man and Forrest Gump as the examples of stories, you know, out there at the time that focused on people with disabilities. And yet I remember sitting in those classes talking to staff and kind of like, okay, I'm not sure this is really the way that we should be doing this. Yeah. Because again, you're looking at these stories and yes, you know, what's coming out of this is this discussion. And oh my gosh, you know, Tom Hanks did an incredible job playing a person with a disability.
Yeah. And I think that's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. And you never really kind of got past the idea that, yeah, you're right. That was just, you know, the mainstream world's way of talking about people with disabilities and not including them in that storytelling process.
And I think it's one of the interesting things too. I mean, I think Peanut Butter Falcon, even though I know there's some mixed things, having an actual man with Down syndrome being the main character and stuff. I mean, there's some really interesting things about how, like, there's memes and jokes about it, and Tropic Thunder sort of makes that joke about how this is, like, the obvious way to win an Oscar is to, you know, as long as you don't overdo it in some ways. And I know, like, with Rain Man falls into the three categories of what generally happens to disabled characters when they're main characters, which is they either get cured, which is sort of, I mean, in some ways Tom Hanks does that too. That movie turns up the term super crip, where you have that scene and at the beginning of the movie where he's running and it's like, run, Forrest, run, when he was a kid. And he literally gets out of his shackles that were, you know, sort of that freedom, like, okay, now he's more normal and it's okay. Now, I do think it's in, I'll go back to that in a second, because I do think, I have mixed sort of thoughts about it, of that, because I do think in some ways there's some true inclusion And the way that Forrest Gump is. He isn't institutionalized. He does have different family members. I mean, he does have a relationship with somebody who's non-disabled, which is sort of a faux pas still, like these ideas of interable relationships, especially with intellectual and developmental disability, is something that's really sort of things. But there's also some problematic tropes. Rain Man is a film I hate because it's that's like become what is the stereotypical definition of autism in some ways, of the savant, and he goes into the three sort of ideas of disability. You either overcome your disability, you get reinstitutionalized, or you die. Even if that's not the main thing, I mean, Million Dollar Baby has it where the character dies, but the person still lives, and it puts a disability, death is better than having a disability. And that really comes from the idea of acquiring a disability is like a death sentence.
Wow. Yeah, it's true. And again, you're right. You see that. And I probably never even thought about that in terms of Million Dollar Baby. But mm-hmm. as soon as you mentioned it, all of a sudden the light bulb went off and it was like, yeah, that's, you're right. That's exactly what happens in that film.
Yeah.
But I think now, because we're talking about a movement from, again, this period that I brought up in the 90s, where you got Rain Man and Forrest Gump, to where we are today. And you mentioned Special as one example. I think one of the other examples that I find really curious in today's world is Atypical.
Yeah,
I know. From Netflix, because they had kind of the standard issue in the beginning, in that they did not have people with disabilities who were part of the writers' rooms or who were involved in the show. But one of the interesting things that they did as a show is they heard all of that chatter during the first season.
It was white autistic males, which is generally the way in that sort of autism narrative, that it's only social awkwardness and stuff, and sort of made it more diverse.
They listened and they found ways to kind of incorporate and embrace these things, which was fascinating to see in the later seasons, because it may have still been problematic in its own way, because you still had that central character, you know, who was being portrayed by someone without a disability. But they had found ways, again, to incorporate other viewpoints, other stories, other characters along the journey. And more importantly, they didn't do that just in front of the camera, but they did it behind the camera as well, which that's ideally where we're headed.
And my hope is that, just like with other people, and we've talked about this before, while you want people with disabilities in front of the camera and behind the camera writing about disability stories, just like with other groups, you just want to be able to tell stories that are human in some ways, whether with or without disabilities or having those elements. I mean, I think some of that is that Special focused in some ways, and I think, I mean, depending on what Atypical, on some of those things, but the characters were more than just their disability. They weren't two-dimensional characters or sort of, you know, it sort of flushed out the characters, and it wasn't just everything. And I think that's one of the things with it, is that a lot of these things are just so focused on disability as the only thing, or the only thing that's afflicting it, or sort of, you know, or that there's something wrong, or, you know, and having that sort of dynamic view of it, and sort of, you know, I mean, just like good comedy, it should be not necessarily just a reflection, just telling a story about people with disabilities. I think what Special does, and maybe what some of the, you know, as there's getting better storytelling, I mean, there's a lot better storytelling around mental health and stuff, I think, and diversity. This is it starting to reflect what it is, of how it is within society and how society treats it. And that it's not just something within the person themselves, but there are things that make it so that the society we have is only set up for some people, and the way their minds and bodies work as well as with race and gender and so
Right.
It doesn't take away that there might be some differences, but it's not solely on the person either.
You know, I feel like this is probably the perfect place to kind of sum up and end this conversation.
Yeah.
And the fascinating thing is, it gets right back to one of the words that you brought up at the very beginning of this that we didn't necessarily specifically talk about, but you hit on it throughout the course of the conversation, and it gets us back to what it means to be human. We are, at the end of the day, all of these identities and everything that we're talking about and working within these systems and the culture of it all, it still boils down to, at the end of the day, we're talking about human experiences. And if we get it back to that level, then that's where you get to see the intersectionality and all of these other pieces all kind of come together. Because at the end of the day, being human is about kind of incorporating all of these elements into a lived experience.
Yeah, and that's the way prejudice works, is that it takes the humanity out of some of it, whether it's around racism or sexism or ableism or other things, is it in some ways takes the humanity out of it and sort of makes it. And I think that has been so much done as well for people with disabilities, that there's something just wrong or defective with them. And I think that we need to understand it's part of being human, that we all have capabilities and we all have ways that we need that. And I think that's also showing in the society to where we're being asked to do so much and be on all the time. Mm-hmm. That I think just as some of these great storytellings tell specifically about the cultures that they're talking about, it's also something that you as a human being can relate to. That I only have so many spoons to give. I can't be working 24/7. I get tired. I need to do it. My brain can only do so much. And you know, I think it's so important to be able to link that, but also be okay with that there's differences. We have similarities, but it's okay that there's differences too.
Yeah. Well, let me just say again, I thank you. Thank you. This was an amazing conversation. I had a lot of fun with this. Yeah. You know, we've been talking about doing this for a while. I'm glad, you know, leading the Lad Way gives us the opportunity to kind of kick this off. And I know for a fact that we're going to have more of these conversations, you know, whether it's in front of cameras and microphones or, you know, off on our own. And I'm really looking forward to having more of those and hopefully having the opportunity to share those with more people. But I want to thank you today for helping us kick things off. I want to thank the listeners who are going to be taking part in this, whether they are people that work at LAD or anyone out there who stumbles upon this podcast in all of the ways that you can. Definitely come at it with an open ears, open mind, and an open heart. And I'm looking forward to, again, having the opportunity to bring you more of these as we go along throughout the rest of the year. So thank you very much.
If I could, and I don't know, I mean, because you just sort of did the outro, just to tie it back into the LAD Way and what LAD's doing, I think this is one of the revolutionary things that LAD is doing and so important, is that they're seeing the bigger picture, that at some point this isn't just about providing services. Providing services is really important, but those services are within a vacuum of a culture and a models and institutions. So being able to have these things and be able to think about culture and diversity, whether it's around disability, whether it's around race and gender and those intersections, are gonna make things better long run, because these things are not in islands or in vacuums. So, I mean, it does seem, and I know it's tough because this stuff is still being worked out and it's a little bit ambiguous, but I think the ideas behind it, the goals behind it, and being able to do this will in the long run make things better for not just LAD, hopefully, but Cincinnati and the city that we're in and the country and hopefully the world, as we come from this from a more empathetic model, more empathetic ideas, and thinking about it more than just tasks to check off.
All right. Well, I am glad to let that be. That's the last word right there from Jason Harris. Thank you very much.
Yeah.